Daniel chapter 4. There are handouts at the back for, I think there's still some back there for chapter 4. There's also some for chapter 5. I've been trying to get those out a week ahead, and that way, if you want to, you can work on them the week ahead, or you can work on them the week after, whichever is more comfortable for you, but to help you get the most out of the lessons and answering the questions and some of the details that we have there. Tom mentioned in his prayer the thankfulness that we can go other places and the church is still there. And, you know, that is a good thing. Daniel and his friends have been taken out of Judah into a foreign land where nobody worships, even the God that they worship. There's no temple there. Of course, this is before the time of the synagogues. But yet, we still find them worshiping, don't we? And so we see in them that even when we go to a place that there's not a church, we can still worship. If there's one Christian there, we can still worship. And if there's two or three there, we can gather together and worship God as He has ordained. And that's what we see Daniel and his friends doing throughout this book. And they're having an influence on other people, even on the king. And we've seen that in the chapters that we've looked at thus far. Chapter 4, the dethroning of Nebuchadnezzar, a dream, and an insane king. An interesting chapter, an interesting turn of events here in this chapter, to say the least. As we begin, we see the declaration of the king, praise of the Most High God. As we begin this chapter, there's a couple things you might notice. One, this entire chapter is Nebuchadnezzar speaking. He says some of the things that Daniel has done and said, but he's the narrator of the entire chapter. And also, especially as we look at this first three verses, we notice a change in Nebuchadnezzar. Remember, he's been influenced by some of the things that have happened. At the end of chapter 1, he finds Daniel and his companions that have been faithful to God to be 10 times better than all of the others that have been going through this training school, you might say, of preparation to serve in the king's palace. At the end of chapter 2, after Daniel interprets the dream, he recognizes that the God of Daniel is a superior God in many ways. He's a God that could give the dream as well as its interpretation. Certainly his gods couldn't do that, or at least his magicians and Chaldeans and others that relied upon their gods could not do that. And so he recognized God. At the end of chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown into the fiery furnace, they're not harmed in any way. He sees one that he describes as the Son of God walking in the midst with them. He again recognizes the superiority of their God, of the God of Israel. But we've noticed in those accounts that he is still a polytheist. That he is just recognizing Jehovah as a great God, but not as the God. But we come to chapter 4, and we see a great change has taken place in Nebuchadnezzar. Notice what he says in the first three verses. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are His signs, how mighty His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion endures from generation to generation. Now this is a declaration, again, from King Nebuchadnezzar. The declaration is to all the peoples, nations, and languages. In other words, he's sending this declaration out to all the known inhabited world. He was ruler over all the known inhabited world. Jeremiah, again, who was a contemporary with Daniel, living in the same time frame, said in Jeremiah 25, verse 26, all the kings of the north, far and wide, one after another, and all the kingdoms of the world that are on the face of the earth, and after them the king of Babylon, shall drink. Talking about again the degree of the kingdom of Babylon. Again, in chapter 27, Jeremiah writes, "It is I who by my great power and my outstretched arm have made the earth." This is God speaking. "With the men and animals that are on the earth, and I give it to whomever it seems right to me. Now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And I have given him also the beasts of the field to serve him." So Nebuchadnezzar has a great kingdom. Where does that kingdom come from? That kingdom came from God. God gave him the things that he has. Why did he do that? Well, Nebuchadnezzar was in many ways an evil king. He was a pagan king. He served other gods. But he's learning a lot as he goes. He's learning a lot from Daniel and his friends. He's learning a lot from the things that God is showing to him. So Nebuchadnezzar does serve a great kingdom. From Elam and Media to the east, to Egypt, to the Mediterranean Sea and its coast from the west, he serves over a great kingdom. But the declaration concerns the mighty works that God has performed before the king. He's at this point seen some mighty things that Jehovah God, the God of Israel, has indeed done. And so he says, his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. That wording there is very similar to the wording that David uses in Psalm 145, verse 13. David says, "Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Your dominion endures throughout all generations." We would expect that from David, wouldn't we? David is a man after God's own heart. We don't expect that as much from old Nebuchadnezzar up there in Babylon. But yet, that's the conclusion that he's come to. The phrase concerning the Most High kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. It is a contrast made to the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar's, his own earthly kingdom, that is variable and perishable. That's going to be going away. Remember, that was what the whole dream in chapter 2 was about. Nebuchadnezzar, you're the great head of gold, but that kingdom's going to perish. But an everlasting kingdom is going to come up in those last days that is going to crush all four of those kingdoms. It's going to be an everlasting kingdom. It's going to know no end. So Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom is perishable, but God's kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. The declaration that Nebuchadnezzar is making was for the purpose of the king's testimony to the grace of God and his power to humble those who lift themselves up with pride. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is going to lift himself up with pride, but he is going to be humbled. And so again, we see a great change has taken place in Nebuchadnezzar. What has happened between the end of chapter 3, the account with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace, and the time that we come to now in Daniel 4, what has transpired? Well, Nebuchadnezzar makes this declaration, and then he goes back and he tells us what's transpired. He tells us what has taken place that's given him an attitude adjustment and caused him to see that God is not only a great God among gods, but God is the God. The God of Jehovah, the God of Israel, is indeed the God to be served. So now he goes back and he's going to tell us now the story of what has brought him to the point of this declaration. And so we see the decree of the king. The wise men are summoned to interpret the dream. We're going to have another dream like we had in chapter 2 and the interpretation of it. Verses 4 through 9. The king's dream. Verses 4 and 5, he says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me." And so the dream came while the king was at ease in his palace, according to verse 4. He was at ease, he was content, he had security. Things seemed to be going well for Nebuchadnezzar. It says he was prospering. The word prospering there literally means growing green, as a plant grows green. Whenever it's healthy and it's doing good and it's growing as it should. That's going to be an interesting word when we come to the interpretation of the dream and what in that dream represents Nebuchadnezzar. He said, I was in my palace. He was secure in his throne, in his kingdom, in his power. So everything seems to kind of be going Nebuchadnezzar's way. And all of a sudden now he has this dream that terrifies him. It troubles him whenever he has this. He says the fancies, the imaginations, the images, the fantasies that are part of this dream. He doesn't understand what it all means, and so it bothers him. It alarms him. The word alarmed there is a stronger word than the word translated afraid. It means that this agitated all the way to the core of the king. It's just really bothering him what this dream might mean. And so the decree sends for the wise men once again, beginning in verse 6. So I made a decree that all the wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make known to me its interpretation. At last Daniel came in before me, he who was named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that my mystery is too difficult, and that no mystery is too difficult for you, tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation. So he calls once again for the wise men. Same thing we saw in chapter 2. He had this vision. He calls for his group of wise men to come in and give the interpretation. He recognizes, though, right up front, it seems here, their inability to interpret the dream. And it seems like maybe even they recognize their inability. Interestingly enough, he hasn't asked them here to give the dream and its interpretation like he did in chapter 2. He just simply asked for the interpretation. But they're not able even to do that. Well, we wonder, why couldn't they just make something up? That's what he was afraid that they might do in chapter 2. That's the reason he wouldn't tell them the dream. But by this point, they may know, Daniel has an ability we don't have. And if we give an interpretation, then Daniel comes along and says something different, that's not going to look good for us. I don't know if that was their reasoning or not, but it could have been. But anyway, they don't give an interpretation. So Daniel enters the picture. He comes in last of all, and the king then appeals to him. Notice the king uses Daniel's Babylonian name, Belteshazzar. He says, after the name of my God. Now we notice the decree there that he's made in verses 1 through 3. But now we've gone back in time. He's at this point not recognizing Jehovah in the same way that he did there in verses 1 through 3. He's still, at this point, believing in a myriad of gods. And so he Belteshazzar, after the name of my God. And then he calls him chief of the magicians. Well, he's already called the magicians and the enchanters and the chandlers, the astrologers. Why did he not call Daniel? Why was he not in that first group? And again, we don't know for certain, but it certainly could be that he was not desirous to deal with Daniel's God. That he realizes the power of Daniel's God, of Israel's God, and if his own wise men can give an interpretation, he'd really rather deal with them and leave Daniel and Daniel's God out of it. But whenever they can't, then he calls in Daniel to give the interpretation. He realizes that he might suffer humiliation through Daniel's God. He probably didn't really like the interpretation of the first dream that well, which predicted that his kingdom would come to an end. Certainly he would have remembered that interpretation from chapter 2. But driven to Daniel's God by necessity, because his own magicians cannot give the interpretation, the king confesses that Daniel Daniel's God is one which pertains to true deity, is to be found in him, or things that pertain to true deity. That he's able to give answers that these Chaldean gods simply cannot give, of course, because they weren't really gods at all. So Daniel is there. He's recognized as being superior once again to these other people. Well, then we have the dream, the contents of the dream. What is this dream that he had all about? Verses 10 through 18. We see a dream that has a tree in the midst of the earth. That's kind of the center, the focal point of this dream, beginning in verse 10. The visions of my head, this is still Nebuchadnezzar speaking, the visions of my head as I lay in my bed were these. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. And so you have this great tree. Now remember that word prospers, Nebuchadnezzar, growing green as a plant. Here we have a great plant, a great tree. And it's great to begin with, but it just continues to grow and grow stronger until it's visible the whole earth. It occupies a central position on the earth, like Nebuchadnezzar does. The tree is growing. It's becoming stronger. It's becoming greater over time. The verbs that are used indicate a state of becoming. It's becoming greater and greater and greater as time continues on. As the king beheld his dream, this tree is growing until it's visible to all the ends of the earth. And this tree is providing food. It's providing shelter for all flesh. All flesh are becoming dependent on this tree for shade, for shelter, for food. All of those things are being given by this great tree. As it continues on, he sees what he describes as a watcher. Again, Nebuchadnezzar is not giving himself over to belief in Jehovah yet. He's still looking at things through his Babylon eyes. And he calls this a watcher, a holy one. Verses 13 through 16. I saw in the vision of my head, and as I lay in my bed, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree, and lop off its branches, strip off its leaves, and scatter its fruit. Let the beast flee from under it, and the birds from its branches, but leave the stump of its root in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and the tender grass of the field. Let him be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beast in the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. And let 7 periods of time pass over him. So he sees a watcher, a vigilant, a holy one. Well, in the interpretation, Daniel is actually going to renounce the pagan king's view of this as a watcher. And so this is a revelation from the Most High God. But again, that's where he's at right now. But this watcher proclaims that this great tree is to be chopped down. Its leaves are to be stripped off. The fruit is to be scattered. So the greatness of this tree is going away. All those that are dependent upon that tree are going to have to find dependence upon something else. But we see that the stump of the tree is to be left, verses 15 and 16. The stump is not completely destroyed. And so the stump of the king remains. He'll be cut down as king when we see the interpretation, but he will remain a man. He will grow again into a king. Exactly what's referred to as the band there, we're not exactly sure. It's not given in the interpretation. Symbolism is left with the phrase, let him be wet. Literally, let him be drenched. And then the actual giving of the dream kind of changes into to an interpretation. It says, let his portion be with the beast. Let his mind be changed from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him. From a man's, and away from that which is human, to a beast. He's no longer going to function in his mind as a man would function. And thus the king's reason is going to be taken away from him. He's going to be acting more like just a lower animal would act, without rationality. And it says, let 7 periods of time pass over him. And so that's the duration of the king's insanity that's coming. 7 periods of time. The length of time can't be determined. The text doesn't tell us what these periods of time are. But the Aramaic word used is very definite that it is a fixed period of time. Some people will believe, well, it's probably 7 years. Maybe it is. But the length of time, what these 7 times are, is simply not given. Then we come to verses 17 and 18. We have the sentence. It says, the sentence is by the decree of the watchers. Again, this is still Nebuchadnezzar talking. The decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men, and gives it to whom he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, O Belteshazzar, tell me the interpretation, because all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. So Nebuchadnezzar states that the sentence, again, it's by the decree of the watchers. Daniel is going to declare it's by the Most High God. But again, that's the difference from the viewpoint that they're coming from still at this time. The demand by the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdoms of God. That God is in charge. Again, Nebuchadnezzar has become very prideful. He thinks he has established this great kingdom, but he's only there at God's good pleasure. And that's the lesson that God is going to give to him. The king acknowledges the inability of these heathen wise men, these pagan wise men, the ability of Daniel, for the spirit, he says, of the holy gods was in him. Again, we can see here he hasn't come down to one God yet, but he believes that these gods, myriad of gods, are working within Daniel. Well, then we come to the definition. Daniel interprets the dream. What do these things mean? Verses 19 through 27. Daniel starts out with a troubled spirit. Whenever Daniel hears this dream and he understands the interpretation, the meaning of the dream, he's troubled by it. In fact, he doesn't at first want to even share it with Nebuchadnezzar. So it began verse 19, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. The king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation alarm you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. As he understood what this meant, he said, no, let this be for someone else besides King Nebuchadnezzar. And evidently, Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar have grown quite close through the years as Daniel has served there in his courts. But Daniel's troubled by what he hears. He immediately understood that this was indeed a judgment from God upon the king. And the king's most likely not going to like hearing that, and so he's silent for a while. His hesitation was not out of fear, but was probably out of respect for the king. It's not easy to tell a person you're going to go crazy. You're going to go insane, especially if this person having to tell the king that. History, in fact, records many messengers who actually deliberately falsified news that they were bringing to the king because it was bad news. Not just King Nebuchadnezzar, but to different kings and potentates throughout history. People didn't like bringing bad news to the king. In fact, sometimes the king would get mad and chop your head off if you brought him bad news. And so sometimes they would change the message. Daniel doesn't change the message, but he is troubled by it and giving this interpretation to the king. But of course, he goes on and gives the interpretation, the truthful statement beginning in verse 20. He says, "It's you, O king. This dream is about you. This great tree that is growing and is going to be cut down, that's you." And so he summarizes the dream beginning in verse 20. The tree you saw, which grew and became strong so that its top reached to heaven and it was visible to the end of the whole earth, whose leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which was food for all, under which beasts of the field found shade, and in whose branches the birds of the heaven lived, it is you, O king, who have grown and become strong. Your greatness has grown and reaches to heaven, and your dominion to the ends of the earth. And because the king saw a watcher, a holy one, is using the king's description, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump of its root in the field, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, and let him be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field, till seven periods of time pass over. So the tree symbolizes the king himself. The king who's grown in power, his empire has grown over the entire known inhabited world, and everyone is, man and beast, is kind of under his wing, so to speak, as he is the great ruler. But also denotes his pride and the extent of his sovereignty, in that he certainly considers himself and is prideful over those things. Beginning verse 24, Daniel says, this is the interpretation. This is the interpretation, O king. It is a decree of the Most High. Again, it's not from watchers. It's from God. It's from the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King, that you may be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven periods of time will pass over you, till you know, notice what the outcome is going to be, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know that heaven rules. So God's going to teach him a lesson. Nebuchadnezzar, you think you did all these great things? And you could put any great world leader in that same statement, really, couldn't you? President Obama, you think you've done many great things. Whoever it is, you're only there because God's allowing you to be there. God still rules in the affairs of men. So Daniel states the truth of the matter. The decree is not from watchers, it's from the Most High God. The king's going to be driven out. He's going to be driven from among men. He's going to go out and live as an animal, live as a beast. He'll be driven from among men, and he'll dwell out in the open as beasts do. He's going to eat the grass of the field as beasts do. Interestingly enough, as you look at Babylonian history, and I think we've mentioned before that the Babylonians were much like the Egyptians. They were very into recording things. And they've left some very detailed writings and so forth that we can go back and verify these things from their own writings as well. But interestingly enough, there's a gap in Babylonian history that seems to fit this time that Nebuchadnezzar is insane. You know, these civilizations, they like to record things, but they only like to record things that made them look good. They didn't record negative things. They didn't record when they went out and lost in battle and those type of things. certainly your king being insane and out grazing in the field with the cows isn't something you're probably going to want to record for history. And so there is a blank time, a gap in history. Certainly seems to fit what's going on here. But the purpose, again, is to bring the king to the knowledge of the truth, that God does reign in the kingdom of men. And so after, he says, after the king knows that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, the kingdom will be returned to him. He will get the kingdom back. That's that stump that is left that will grow once again into a tree. But he's going to get a lesson in humility first. Well, as Daniel gives the interpretation, again, he's a little hesitant up front. He gives the interpretation. But then notice verse 27. Daniel pleads with the king that he repent. He pleads with him for piety and purity. He says, "Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity." So Daniel urges Nebuchadnezzar to repent. Change your ways. Maybe that will have an influence. He doesn't say that it will. God hasn't told Daniel that it will. And so he doesn't say that this plot will be averted by doing so. But it certainly can't hurt anything, can it? For the king to straighten up his ways. The judgment was for the very purpose of bringing truth and the means of turning the king around. But Daniel says, get your life straight. Straighten up your act before God. And so he speaks of the possibility of the lengthening of the king's prosperity. Not the guarantee of it, but the possibility of it. Then we come to the dream fulfilled, verses 28 through 37. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. First of all, the king's insanity. It says beginning verse 28, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?" Notice the pride in the statement. 12 months have passed from the time that this dream has been, they've had this dream and its interpretation. But now he's looking at Babylon, looking, old chest puffed out, looking at what I've done. The accuracy of the phrase, "which I have built," is fairly accurate in some ways. Nebuchadnezzar had done some great things in Babylon. We go back again to some of those recordings that we have, and we see that he renovated two temples of Marduk in Babylon and the temple of Nebo in Borsippa. There were 15 other temples that he restored and rebuilt. He completed two great walls around the city, a rampart, And he built a palace for Nebuchadnezzar. In 15 days, it said that he constructed a palace to which was connected the great hanging gardens of Babylon. That was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And so he had indeed done some amazing things, but again, how did he do them? He did them through the power of God and through God allowing him to be in that position to do them. And so the sentence comes. 12 months later, it comes while the words were still in his mouth. As he's speaking these prideful words, verse 31. While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and seven periods of time shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom He will." Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men, and he ate grass like an ox. And his body was wet from the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. So again, as soon as he's speaking these words, while these words are still in his mouth, immediately this voice fell and heard a revelation from God. God saying these things, this dream, this vision is now being fulfilled. He says the kingdom has departed from you. He doesn't say it is departing from you. It's not even in present tense. It's in past tense. It has departed. It's already taken place. The kingdom is gone. It's no longer yours. The result of his insanity, his hair grew as long as resembled eagle's feathers. His nails grew sharp and long like bird's claws. There is a medical condition called insania zoanthropy. I'm probably butchering that name. That is actually a condition where the sufferer imagines himself to be an animal and to a certain extent acts like one. And Nebuchadnezzar's form of the disease is called boanthropy. He thought himself to be an ox. And so he lived like an ox. He grazed like an ox. But in verses 34 and 35, we see the king's humility. That's what we've been driving toward, isn't it? The humility in place of the pride in this man. And so verse 34, at the end of the days, what days? The end of this seven periods of time, however long that was. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion and His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And He does according to His will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay His hand and say to Him, what have you done? Notice again the change in his recognition of who God is. None can stay His hand and say to Him, what have you done? Remember what He asked back in chapter 3? Who can deliver you from this fire? Well, at the end He said, well, your God evidently can deliver you from the fire. You know, who can stop God from doing anything that He wants to do? And so at the end of the days, the king looked humbly toward heaven. He now recognizes the source of his help. He knows the eternal God alone is his strength. What a change in the man. The king humbly confesses in an outstanding declaration of God's sovereignty and God's power. None is like him. No kingdom is like his. None can oppose his action. None can question what he's doing. Not even someone as great as King Nebuchadnezzar himself. And then verses 36 and 37, we see his recovery. At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors, my lords, sought me, and I was established in my kingdom. And still more greatness was added to me. Notice he's going to have even more greatness afterwards than what he had before. Verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven. For all his works are great and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Notice the change. No longer, Daniel, you're a one whom the gods have given these abilities and so forth. But no, he says, the King of heaven. The God. What a change. His understanding returns, his splendor and his glory return and is even added to. His place as king among his kingdom officials is restored. They're once again coming to him for counsel, his praise and his honor of the King of heaven. Well, the question, was Nebuchadnezzar truly converted at this point? Did he truly leave at this point those pagan gods and truly worship the God of heaven? Well, as we look at the progression of his knowledge and the confession that he makes, his knowledge has certainly been growing. At the end of chapter 2, again, he recognizes Daniel's God as a great God who can give interpretations and dreams that these other gods cannot. At the end of chapter 3, he recognizes the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as a great God that can deliver out of a fiery furnace that he could not imagine any God being able to do. And now look at the words here. The Most High, the King of Heaven. His works are right, His ways are just. Those who walk in pride, He's able to humble. He confesses here at the end of chapter 4 the complete sovereignty of God. That God is the God who's in charge of all things. He acknowledges the power of God. Again, here at the end of chapter 4. And he worships this God whom he calls the King of Heaven. So certainly it appears to me as we look at this that he is now at the point that he believes in one God. He's been convinced by the things that Daniel and his friends have done, as well as what God has done, that there is indeed one God. Turn over, if you would, with me very quickly to 1 Timothy chapter 4. I was thinking of this as we were at the Summer Youth Series on Tuesday night, and Brother Bonner used this as his text for his lesson. 1 Timothy chapter 4, beginning in verse 12. Paul writing to Timothy said, Let no one despise you for your youth, but set the believers an example in speech and conduct and love and faith and purity. Until I come, devote yourself to the public reading of Scripture, to exhortation, to reading, or to teaching. Do not neglect the gift you have, which is given you by prophecy when the council of the elders laid their hands on you. Practice these things. Immerse yourself in them, so that all may see your progress. Keep a close watch on yourself and on the teaching. Persist in this, for by so doing, you will save both yourself and your hearers. In Daniel, we've got four young men. Timothy's probably in his 30s at this point. These young men, when they're taken from their homes, are probably about 14, 15 years old. But notice the effect they've had in Babylon. Because they did not let anyone despise their youth, but they continued to serve their God. They continued to serve Jehovah in the face of death, in the face of a fiery furnace, in the face of an agitated, ruthless king. But they're having an influence. We can have an influence in the world, brethren, if we'll just take Jesus out and live it and teach it before man. What does he say here to Timothy? You'll save both yourself and your hearers. Let's have an impact in Brownwood, Texas, like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego are having in the nation of Babylon, even with the king of Babylon. Lesson is yours. Is anyone here who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation? That invitation is open. Whether you need to be baptized for remission of sins, you need the prayers of your brothers and sisters, we're going to assist you this evening if you let that be known as we stand and sing.